Well, welcome this afternoon to the sunny lawns of Adelaide on the west stage, I think it is, of Adelaide Writers' Week. I'm Amanda Vanstone. If you've come from Adelaide, you've probably heard of me. If you don't come from Adelaide, you might not have. But anyway, just think X has been, that'll do. And we are going to interview Umut Uzkurumli. He's Turkish by birth. Then went to some Nordic countries, and I think now is in Portugal. But he has written a book, cancelled, The Woke Way Out for the Left. Quite why he wants to help the left, I'm not sure, but I'm not going to argue about that. The interest in the book is it does explain quite a lot about woke culture. So let's see if we've got Umut online, have we? There you are. Hello, Umut, how are you?
Fine. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, we're in a sunny Adelaide. Where are you and what temperature is it where you are?
I'm in Barcelona, actually. I live in Spain.
Lucky dog.
Not as hot as Adelaide. I just checked. You have 28. We are around 20 right now.
Lovely, lovely. Anyway, look, thanks very much for agreeing to have a chat about this book, which, as you know, I love. But I think we've got a video to show you first, just to give you an idea about what the book's about or the intention of where Umut wants to go. Are you happy we show that video now, Umut?
Of course,
okay.
Sure.
You happy? Yes, it's going to happen. That's the theory. Is there sound? If you're at the back and can't read, it's not very long. There we go. This book will make you think. Well, it will. It made me think. Some of you might say, well, there's a change, but that would be unkind of you to say that. Can I just say before Umut will be there, but one of the things I like about this book, look, it's not a happy read. You know, don't sit down on Sunday afternoon with a gin and tonic and think, right, I'm going to have a lovely afternoon, I'm going to stick my beak into this and have a great time, like you might with a cookbook or a novel. But on the other hand, if you want to get some idea about what's going on with cancel culture, which is infesting the world, this is the ticket. Because it's, what would you say, modular. You can do it in bits. So you don't have to attack it as a whole. And by the time you get to the end of it, you will be much, much better off. But in bits, that's what I like about, I won't call it a textbook, but I do like to be able to come at things in bits. Now, Umut, welcome again. Can you tell me, you've been cancelled at one point, haven't you? And can you tell us why?
Yeah. I mean, that was the beginning of the journey, actually. It was one of the weirdest stories of cancellation because
Where were you working when that happened? Where were you working?
As you said, I was born in Turkey and then I left Turkey in 2010. So I was living in Sweden and I was raising a little boy called Luca, who was the love of my life. And I'm using was because it will become clear what happened later. So, yeah, I mean, the cancellation thing was really mean, you know, an ex-colleague felt a little bit uneasy after a breakup. And then, you know, this was just a workplace conflict. But when it hit the Twitter, as you know, that kind of, you know, this bottomless pit, it turned into a story of harassment and sexual harassment, even though it had nothing to do with it, even the complaint. And the Turkish state, with, you know, who doesn't particularly like me for my views, because, you know, I'm secular, you know, I'm critical of the government and all of that, they jumped on the bandwagon, and in 24 hours, I became a terrorist as well. And all of these things were happening when, and that's the story. I mean, our son died of a rare cancer at the age of 5 and a half. And I was in, I left Sweden and I came to Spain to relocate, and I was working, I was working on myself. I was trying to stay alive, survive this. And as this thing happened, and I guess, you know, there are different ways of grieving. In my case, rage was easy to come by. So my cancellation was happening, you know, did happen when I was grieving for the loss of my son. And it involved a government which called me a terrorist, and I was living in Spain. That was it.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's what made me realize that there is something wrong.
Yeah, well, there definitely is. Now, in the video, we could see, you know, people burning books in the lead up to World War II, during World War II, and I'm sure we could find film clips of that happening well before that and since then. But then we see J.K. Rowling being chucked on a fire, a writer of kids' books. So this is quite a pervasive idea, isn't it? That you've said something we don't like and we're going to get rid of what you've said.
Well, that's exactly the thing. I mean, what I would like to say, you said it's not an easy read, but in many ways, and you're right, it's not a novel, but I mean, it's highly readable because I tried to relate everything to what's happening, you know, some of the things that we'll probably talk about, what's happening in the world, you know, the Women's March in Washington in 2017, the Capitol Hill riots, book burnings and all of that, because my idea was not about, you know, writing just another memoir of cancellation to make a living out of that. I'm an academic, I was an academic, born to a writer father, so I was interested and I liked writing. So I just wanted to do some kind of, you know, reflection of what I learned through this experience. Because people that I thought were in the same political tribe as me were the first ones, so-called progressive, so-called feminist, LGBTQ rights defenders, they were the ones who were first to grill me. So I started to reflect. I started to look around and then I saw that, yeah, this is a general problem. It's not about right or left or anything.
No, a lot of people do it on all sides. You make the point, though, that you would say a time ago, I'm not sure how long, 10 years, 15, 20 years, the left generally had a set of coherent theories that people would find their way where to sit in that theory, and it was all moving along reasonably well. And now with what we'll call the woke movement, that's sort of splintered. There doesn't seem to be coherent theory holding things together now. One group is yelling at another group. This is within the left, but it's true within the right as well. And people just announcing what they think about this, that or anything else is causing a great disruption amongst the left generally. Now, you know, I vote for the right of centre party, so I should be happy with that, but it's happening everywhere. And in my own view, this is not a good thing, because what we should be doing is sitting down discussing things with each other in a coherent way, not finger-pointing. But do you think people on the left realise what a risk this wokeism is to the structure of their thought process?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, that's the whole problem. There's nothing left of the left. I mean, one of the kind of, I try to use as many sound bites or slogan-like things as possible, not cheesy ones, but I mean, one of the aims of this book is to reclaim the left from this parasitic movement, basically, because that's not progressive. I mean, what is progressive about burning books? As you said it, J.K. Rowling is one of the authors that you know, whose books have been written, burned most. It started with evangelical Christians. It continued with Trump voters because, you know, she was critical of Trump. And all of a sudden, since 2021, transactivists started to burn her books, allegedly because she was transphobic. If you ask them, what did she say or do that qualifies her as transphobic, none of them had seen anything. They just read some things on social media. That's it. So if a movement which calls itself progressive reaches the point of burning books, something that, as you rightly pointed out, and we've seen in the clip that the Nazis have done in 1930s, then I think, you know, everybody should give it a hard talk, you know, thinking about what's going on. We don't have a word to say. We don't have a story to tell. We don't have a vision to sell, but we have books to burn.
Yeah. Can you just share with us what you think about the trigger warnings? I know it might have been you, but certainly when I did ABC Counterpoint, we interviewed someone about trigger warnings, which were initially established for post-traumatic stress disorder people. And since then, they've subsequently discovered that it doesn't work for them. We have to help them handle life, not avoid it. Not there's a trigger, don't go in that room. Learn to handle the room. But you had an example in relation to suggestions about what could or could not be taught in criminal law because it might upset people. Can you share that with this audience? Because I found this a spectacularly stupid suggestion.
Exactly. I mean, trigger warnings don't work. There are lots of scientific studies which show that they actually produce the opposite effect. You know, they traumatize people. They're like, you know, preparing them to be traumatized. And of course, you know, it's also, they say that it's like parental advisory warnings and all. Well, we're talking about university students, you know, young adults, so we can't infantilize them. And this was this example, I saw it in New Yorker by a Harvard law professor, Jenny Gerson. She's teaching law in Harvard. And there were complaints about her because she was teaching rape law. Now, it's part of the curriculum. How can you not teach rape law to prospective, you know, prosecutors, judges, and advocates? So there were complaints, and it was like, you know, maybe we should drop the topic altogether. But there are other ridiculous examples. I mean, I know, you know, you've spent your life in politics. In a journalism school in Leeds University, they sent a memo to students saying that don't use capital letters because that could traumatize people.
And how would that be?
I mean, I have no clue.
Can I say, it is, to me, plainly ridiculous and damaging to anyone who wants to advance the cause of women to suggest that you wouldn't teach rape law. It should be more clearly understood, especially by young men. But at least I get why someone says that. Oh, I don't want to hear about it. Well, don't go to the class. But the capital letters, it's lost on me. What's the reasoning?
Well, apparently it triggers trauma in certain people. I mean, really, we should actually just, with the audience, make an agreement. Like, let's just say a comradely or kind of a, you know, intimate agreement. Everything that I say are documented, you know, referenced, etc. But let's not try to look for any logic on these things. No. I'll give you another example. Evergreen University, United States. This was at the height of Black Lives Matter protests. They sent a memo to professors saying that, you know, you should cut some slack to students who are taking part in the protests. Fine. You know, I thought when I read about this, I said, of course, why not? You know, I'm in Catalonia. There are demonstrations here too. But what they said was, you have to be lenient when grading students who took part in protests. And this last one that I'll give you, this is, Amanda, you fought, I know I've read so many things about you. Look, I mean, in University of St. Louis in Washington, this famous theater play, Vagina Monologues, was going to be shown, okay? And it's a feminist play. And they because they thought the word vagina would discriminate against people who don't have it, they changed the name, the title of this famous play into the ... monologues. Blank. They left it blank.
It's just incredible.
Because, you know, it's insensitive of people who, they say women with other genitals.
Yeah. Now,
where are the gain? I mean, I'm a man. I'm not supposed to be talking about this, but what happened to feminism?
Yeah. Now, can we just go to something that can possibly affect all of us? Doesn't matter what your politics are, your gender, your sexuality, your age group, it's irrelevant. The crowd, and it's a mixed and varied crowd, it's not a unified crowd, that's part of the problem, but a group of people who might decide to try and cancel you or cancel a concert or, you know, in some way bring you down, do so because presumably they've decided that what you're saying or doing or have done or said is not in everyone else's interest. But this is a real problem for everybody, because who decides what's not in everyone else's interest for you to say or you to say, or you, Umut, or me? And how do these people appoint themselves? What can you tell us about them? To me, they seem just self-appointed busybodies. But what would you say?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the point. I mean, they say that they're cancelling you in order to protect the rights or the feelings of marginalized groups. But, I mean, they're actually exercising power themselves in many ways. Because, yeah, the dictionary definition of cancel culture is to boycott or to censor views that are seen. This is the Oxford Dictionary definition, that are not culturally acceptable. But what are culturally acceptable? Which culture? Whose culture? Who decides that, as you said? I mean, maybe some of the things that I say are offending to some people in the crowd. They can just leave. As long, of course, there are legal boundaries set by hate speech, inciting to violence and all of that, racism, etc. But we're not talking about these things. You know, we're talking about pronouns, misgendering people, which might happen accidentally. And then how do we learn? Because cancel culture is also, as you know, it's not like something that comes and goes. There are no statute of limitations. If you're canceled, you're supposed to die socially. So that's exactly, you know, one of the things that you and I were talking over the phone. You know, who loses, or what is it that we lose, you know, in this? And that is really irrespective of politics. We lose our freedom.
Now,
freedom of speech, freedom of thinking.
Sure. Can we go back to the really big, huge Women's March in, you can remind me what year it was, and what that's now been reduced to in terms of numbers, and why that might have happened? And the reason I ask this is there was an enormous, very, very successful Women's March in the United States in 2000 and something, I think just after Trump got elected, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's nothing like that now, and there's a reason for that. And I think it's helpful for all of us to understand, well, how does that happen? So how did that happen?
That was a broad coalition. I mean, that's the story that I start the book with. I mean, you know, those who are interested in the book will see that I start each chapter with a real story, with what happened, in order to make the things that I say more, you know, intelligible, you know. And this was the case when Trump was elected, because of his, some of his, as we know, infamous comments about women, etc., the locker room talk, right? Women decided to organize. It wasn't a top-down thing, you know. It happened on Facebook. Women came together. And basically, after his own inauguration in January, the day after that, I think it was January 21, 2017, women from all walks of life, black, white, trans, lesbian, straight, you know, everybody, pro-abortion, anti-abortion. And this was the single largest demonstration in recorded U.S. history. And according to estimates by political scientists that I trust, there were 4 million people in that march in Washington and all over the United States. To give just an idea, this corresponds to 1.6% of American population. And the whole American army consists of 2 million people. So this was huge. But what happens? The woke left comes and says, oh, okay, we have a problem with these famous pink pussy hats that you're wearing. That was actually, you know, an attempt to reclaim these kind of misogynistic slurs that Trump was using.
Crocheting or knitting vagina hats.
Yeah, the knitted things. And by the way, the two women who invented this did not make any money out of it. You know, they were making the donations to women's charities. So they said, first of all, why vagina? Again, the usual thing, excuse of transgender people. Why pink? Black, brown woman. Why knitting? Because knitting in 19th century Europe was a colonial practice. And then that started with that. And then they had problems with, was it inclusive enough, not inclusive enough? Was it anti-Semitic? Should we include conservative women? And why not? Because, you know, aren't they women? So what happened is, after all these talks, just fast forward 5 years, in 2021, 4 million, these 4 million women who protested against Trump in 2017, they became 5,000. So this is what happens to politics. If
when you
start dividing the group, it divides, well, it reduces, it kills it.
Well, I think you're right to say it can happen to the left. It can also happen to the right, and has been. But it happens to nation states as well, and communities, families. Once you start picking off and dividing, you're screwed, basically, unless you can find a way to come back together. Now, you have got an example of a woman who, from your book, appears wonderful. I've never met her, never heard about her before, but had some pretty horrific life experiences. And instead of doing a poor me, write about me, focused about getting something done, which is so refreshing. I don't know about where you are in Spain, but we have a lot of people who like to focus on the wrong that's happened to them. And I don't say we should not take any notice of the wrongs that happen to people. But advertising the wrong that's happened to you just advertises the wrong. Getting something done is different. So her name was Loretta. Tell us about Loretta. She's a star.
Yeah, Loretta J. Ross is a very famous reproductive rights activist, black feminist. I mean, her life story was amazing. I just came across her in a New York Times article while I was doing research for my book, because, you know, the book is not only criticizing and it's not about complaining. See, I'm against cancel culture itself, so I don't like victimizing. And then I found out this black feminist activist who said the same things. And then I read about her life story and I realized, whoa. I mean, I just lost a son and I was canceled by the government, but I survived. And it took me 3-4 months to win my case. And that's it, you know, legally. She was raped at the age of 8 for the first time by a stranger. Then at the age of 14 or 16, she was raped again by a distant cousin and got pregnant. And because she wanted to give birth to her son, who was an incest kid, she lost her scholarship to university because the university said, you have to get an abortion. Then at the university, she was gang raped. And not only that, she was also the victim of this birth control device that was actually experimented on black women, young women at universities, given out freely, Deacon Shield it was called. And she was almost losing her life. And at the age of 26, they removed her womb to save her life. And she started a class action suit against this company, which went bankrupt in the end. So what would you expect, like, if this were a Generation Z, a millennial woman? Probably, you know, set up a YouTube channel, make money out of her stories and all of that. No, Loretta became an activist. First of all, she started to work with ex-Ku Klux Klan people, racism and all of that. But the story that I tell in the book is a really serious one. She became the director of Washington, D.C. Rape Crisis Center. And one day they received a letter from this guy who was in prison for murder. And the guy, William Fuller, said to them, look, you know, I came across some feminist books in prison. I used to rape women outside. Right now I'm in with men and I continue raping. So I think that the problem is with me. So how do I stop from raping people? Could you please come and help me? Now, this was the most extraordinary request they received. A guy who was there for murder and rape, asking for their help. So Loretta and her friend just said, okay, look, we can fix the problems with band-aids, etc. But as long as we change men who rape, we can't stop this problem. So they decide to, you know, just go and meet William. Long story short, they spent all day Friday afternoons for 2 years there reading books and talking to these rapists. This has become, this is in the annals of the American state. William, later on, set up the first prison rape crisis center on his own. He was condemned, you know, he was sentenced to life. He was forgiven and you know, he went out and gave it testimony to the Congress. And this has become a blueprint, a model for all, you know. So if a woman who's been raped so many times by men and has suffered racism can work with racists or former racists and rapists and make a change, I think that's a story that everybody should read and learn about.
Yeah, someone should make a movie out of it because...
There's a documentary.
You say she's famous. I hadn't heard of her. I don't know if any of you had, but, you know, that's a tragic story for a woman, and to end up achieving something where at least in one prison there's a lot of work being done with rapists is a real achievement, I think. Now, can we just spend a little bit of time on the internet? You know, when they burned books in the past, it might have been in the village square and everyone went along and cheered and chucked a book on and there was that horrible mob contagion that spreads. It's one of my tips for life. If ever you find out you're in a mob or think you are, take a step back, get out, because it's not a good place to be a mob. But now you don't need a town square, do you? You can just light a book and film it with a micro camera and blow it up and add all the colours and make it fantastic and put it on the net. That's playing a role as well, isn't it? Apart from these self-appointed do-gooders who interfere on everyone else's behalf when they're not elected to do so, they can put one thing on the net and spread it like wildfire in a way that someone saying something in a village square couldn't.
Exactly, and it reaches millions. I mean, the most famous story of this, it was before cancel culture was even invented. A South African woman, a British or American woman, whatever, by the name of Justine Sacco. She's very famous. She has become famous. This was just with the beginning of the internet age. She was going on a trip to South Africa and she made a really kind of tasteless, crass joke before boarding on the plane, saying that, she forgot to have her HIV vaccine, but that's okay, she is white. Okay, so it's stupidly racist, it's just a joke, it's you know, who cares? And she has, by the way, 40 followers on Twitter. So it's just to her 40 follower friends. She takes the plane to a long trip, 9 hours, she lands in Johannesburg, switches off her phone, and she realizes that she's become viral because someone discovered this joke. Now, in a matter of hours, she loses her job. She realizes that she has become a hashtag while she was sleeping on the plane because someone put a tracker on her flight and there was a hashtag called "Has Justin Landed Yet?" So people sitting in their rooms were following the plane flying to South Africa, and that's the story. That's the beginning of that. You know, it was amazing. When these cancellation campaign began about me, and Turkey is not a small country. Huh? We were talking about 80 million people, and we're within family. I'm a little bit known in the academia and all of that, also political activism and all of that. I was a trending topic for 24 hours. Never have been before as a terrorist. That was, you know, that's something that you cannot control. I mean, this is insane because we're talking about famous people, which of course is also like J.K. Rowling, Dave Chappelle. They suffer too. Okay, they have money and they can fight back and they're not canceled. Fine. But there are also examples of people who commit suicide.
Yeah.
Who lose everything they have.
Yeah, no, I get it. You mentioned that this sort of activity, the finger pointing, the cancelling, you know, you lose your job, you don't necessarily know why. I certainly know one example, appalling example of that. Because someone thinks it's just better if you're not there because then they won't have to deal with nasty public debate and you lose your job. But plenty of people have lost a lot more than that. And you say it's about our freedom. I agree with that. I put it another way, though, that this is clutter. Clutter in the political space. And it doesn't matter how you want to vote, who you want to vote for. You know, you can vote for Mary Treetops or something. It's not the point. If the space in which you get to hear about what people say they're going to do in Parliament or what they have done in Parliament or what they've done outside and you're deciding what you think about it, if that space is littered with clutter and rubbish, stuff that isn't true, that's been taken out of context, blown out of all proportion, whacked on the net and made to look as if it's some dramatic statement, then you and I are not able to get the information we need as clearly and easily as we can. It's as though we're landing, I don't know, a bomber in World War II through a lot of flak. And in that way, I think it diminishes, I'd say, our political process, but in that sense, our freedom as well, because we choose who we elect. We kick out governments when we don't like and we elect another one. We do that with quite a bit of frequency here. I'm not sure about Spain. Or they'd have a long time without a government for a while, didn't they?
They had
a caretaker, they couldn't agree.
They're quite volatile as well.
Yeah. But do you agree that, you know, you say it takes our freedom, that it's damages the underpinning of the political process, because that underpinning relies on normal people being able to get pretty decent information about what's been happening and what's planned to happen and who says what. And when we have people from the side yelling in, it messes it up. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, that was my start. I mean, that was the one of the main ideas that I worked on. I mean, the people who invented identity politics in the 70s, these feminist activists, were actually trying to do politics. You know, identity was one way of doing politics for them. But right now, what we see with this cancel culture and all of these things, the clutter, as you say, now politics is about identity. So there's no politics in it. Identity is something sacred that only you can decide, however you define yourself, and that's it. There's no politics. There's no debate. Yeah. So not only that, we don't want to speak to each other, and plus, as you said, there's a lot of noise. Obviously, there's no dialogue. I mean, how am I going to, you know, one of the things that I found, well, I expected it after working so much on cancel culture, but none of the mainstream left-wing liberal newspapers in the UK, United States, or Australia covered the book. They just ignored it. Whereas I'm being offered open arms. I've been asked to speak to right-leaning audiences, to conservatives, to centrists, to liberals. And when you say yes, because you believe in dialogue and learning and listening, you're called a fascist or a bigot. Now, since when politics and listening to people has become something that we call bigotry or reactionary? How are we going to survive all these bad things that are happening, wars, climate, and all of that, if we don't even talk to each other?
That's a very fundamental point, and one that's lost on some of the woke people. Can I just ask you what you know about the Me Too movement, which seems to me to be one that's been, because the woke people tend to grab a slogan and go and bash someone with it. They don't invent their own necessarily. A group might go, I'm going to use that one. Me Too was actually started by an African-American in the United States.
Yeah.
And she came up with the idea of the name Me Too because someone, a young girl, had been telling her about this horrific experience she'd been through, and the woman had been through something very similar. But she just didn't think, she hadn't told everybody about it, and she didn't have it in her to put her arm around the person and say, yes, me too. And she felt really bad about that. Lazy, you know, lacking in courage, shall we say. Weak. So she said, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to start a Me Too movement. And it's going to be there to help people who've been attacked in this way. And what has it become? It's been taken over and used as a way of attacking blokes, which is not to say that blokes who attack women shouldn't be attacked, but this woman did a fabulous job and it's been taken over. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she... It's also mentioned as one of the examples in the book. It's Tarana Burke. She was in Bronx, and she set up this charity helping especially women of color, but all women who were subject to, you know, rape, sexual abuse, violence, etc. And she didn't, you know, she wasn't famous. Nobody knew about her or her work other than the people that she was helping. But then it was taken over by celebrities, Hollywood, etc. And yes, some good came out of it as well. We got rid of people like Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, etc. Fine. But then, you know, this wasn't what Tarana Burke, when she started the movement, thought about, envisaged. And she herself openly distanced herself from the movement in 2020. I've read several interviews that were done with her, and she actually, you know, they're quoted in the book as well. She doesn't like it because she wanted to do the work. She didn't want to enjoy celebrity, or she didn't want to be, you know, and that doesn't mean that, as I said, of course, you know, many, there are lots of rapists or people who are guilty of violation, but that's another thing. You know, we should just, of course, try to bring them to justice. But what about, you know, what about using this as a tool, again, turning this into a completely different thing? Just like social media, which was supposed to be helping us to spread information, not to spread disinformation.
Or hate.
So
yeah.
Tarana Burke didn't support Me Too as it was. And right now, six years after that, we don't have that much of a strong movement.
No. Well, there's a woman who had a terrible experience, tried to help, had a movement taken over, and, I don't want to be unkind, but I think it's now used by upper middle class women to promote their stories more than it is to help the people who've been affected. Put it this way, I haven't seen the Me Too movement in Australia support a girl who works in a butcher shop who claims she was raped. It's always got to be someone in a big company or associated, the perpetrator has to be well known, or the victim has to be well known. If you're just a normal citizen, a young girl who is raped or sexually assaulted in some other way, I think you've got Buckley's of getting Me Too to help you and make you their cause. You probably don't know what Buckley's means. You haven't got a hope if you're in that position of getting them to help you. Can I just ask you about... do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to just say that, you know, this is the whole point about the whole, you know, the woke movement. You know, it's a very kind of middle-class, privileged people taking on the cause just because they want to feel, they want to show that they're virtuous. You know, that's the word virtue signaling comes in. And Loretta, in this article that I discovered her from, she says, look, you know, activism and movements, etc., they're not your therapy couches. Go to your therapist and deal with it on the couch. Activism is something serious. Mm. You just try to save lives.
Yeah.
Okay? You fail or you succeed is another matter.
Bureaucracies of all sorts are battling with diversity and inclusion training. It's so easy for these things to become ticker box. Yes, we've run a course. Yes, we've got 10% this, 5% this, tick, tick, tick. As opposed to getting it to fundamentally work in the bureaucratic structure. There's a AMP is a big financial firm in Australia, and the just announced retiring chairman, says this is one of the great problems, is to make sure that you get DEI actually functioning in your organisation, not just running a course and saying, yes, we've ticked the box. In some cases, that can be counterproductive, running courses, can't it? Do you agree?
In pretty much all cases. You know, the diversity training things is just, again, it's like a Band-Aid, you know? It's just you give them 20-hour course and you expect people to change. I mean, even if you're good willing, how do you do that? But I mean, it's just an industry. I mean, look at the big names of this industry. There are some in United States, you know, Robin DiAngelo, Ibram Kendi, lots of people. You know, it's a $1 billion business. And change doesn't happen with that. You know, that's the only thing that the woke left doesn't understand. You know, by changing names of certain things, we make progress. Okay, you call something X instead of Y, and that's it. The thing has changed. No, that doesn't happen that way. Actually, it makes people more aware of their own racism. It produces backlash among the majority groups because they don't like to feel guilty. And how can you train people? Like, you know, and if you look at the portfolio of these trainers, you will see that they're all teaching big companies like Amazon, Unilever, et cetera, and they charge $20,000 per hour. $20,000. I've never seen that kind of money in my life. And you know what? That's the thing. Loretta was doing a workshop with lots of people. I registered for it because why? And I was with hundreds of people, by the way, from different parts of the world. It was 36 hours, 6 weeks, and you know how much it was? $36, the whole course.
Because she cared.
Because she wasn't trying to make money.
No.
Because she wanted to achieve change.
Yeah, there's a big difference. Look, I don't want to let you get away with asking you about some Turkish food ideas, because I know you grew up there. I do want to say, I didn't mean to imply this book's a hard read. I didn't find it hard to read at all. In fact, I read it in an afternoon and a night with a few other things stirring the pot and stuff happening. It's not a hard read. But I did mean to say it's not a novel or, you know, the Woman's Weekly. There's real thought in this book. And I think it's great you've done it, because it's an issue that needs collating so that people can read about it, decide whether they agree with you or not on a whole range of things, and look at these woke arguments in a more informed light. So this is not for an enjoyable afternoon, although it will be enjoyable. It's for a thinking afternoon, and you will be so pleased with yourself when you know all about it. Now, Turkish recipes. The imam swooned or the imam fainted. The one with the lamb eggplant and the bechamel,
you know,
and the cheese. Are you good at that? Do you cook that?
Well, I used to cook for my son. Not much right now. Well, but then again, Spain has its own amazing cuisine, so not that much.
Okay.
But I'm looking forward to
all
the...
Do it another. If you went home, is your mum still alive?
Oh, yeah. She's 84, and she'll be watching this at some point, yeah.
Okay. Okay, you're going home to Turkey. Mum's there. You're on the plane, and you're thinking, I wonder what she's cooked tonight. What are you hoping she's cooked?
Oh, it's not hoping. It's a request, and she knows. She was asking me the other day, because I'm going there for Easter, and she said, okay, shall I start doing it? I said, yes. The it that I'm talking about is... that's a very Mediterranean thing, actually, because it exists in Greece. Stuffed wine leaves.
Stuffed
with
wine
rice.
Leaves?
Stuffed wine leaves, yes.
Okay.
It's a very tricky recipe because, you know, it has to be, you know, it's cooked rice, but very soft. Wine leaves are being, you know, prepared beforehand, and then, you know, you have to wrap them like an artist because, you know, they have to be thin, and all of that. We call it in Turkish dolma, which means stuffed. The Greeks call it dolmades, exactly the same meaning. Well, the Ottoman background. It's one of my favorite things. And, well, for those who are vegetarian, vegan, it works for them too.
Yeah, sure. Okay, what about a sweet dish? After you've had your dolma.
Oh, sweet dish. Well, I'll go for the traditional baklava.
Baklava, okay.
The thing with pistachios.
You are fussy about the nuts. You do want pistachios, okay. Some people like walnuts, but that's okay.
Okay, yeah, I do.
Now, let's see.
You can have walnuts, too. And you can have it with cream.
Okay, a bit rich, but okay, good. Now, would anyone like to ask Umut a question? I think not. Yes, there is. And a microphone is coming to you. Well, you're going to the microphone. Yes, there are quite a few, Umut. So no more food. We'll have to shut up about that. Please.
You're talking about the problems of diversity and inclusion programs and the bureaucracy it creates. But there is another solution. It's called quota systems, 50% women on your, the directorship of the company, etc. I don't know if that's any cheaper, but it's a more straightforward way of doing it. Comment?
Umut? Can you hear that, Umut?
I could. It's perfect. The quota system works it was a very important tool in terms of increasing women's participation. It depends on which quota system, which kind of, because the affirmative action is a very tricky business. That's what our friend is asking. The quota of including, a certain percentage of women in politics, of course, this is really something progressive. But if you start using quotas to give anybody from any group that defines itself as marginalized, then without looking at merit and everything, then we saw some of the things that happened in United States universities, the Ivy League and everything. Because, and the people who suffered from it were not the majority whites, were the Asians. Because the Chinese students were some of the best ones. And because of the quota system, they lost out to other groups, for instance. So quotas are tricky. I wouldn't say that they are as useless as diversity, equity, whatever these DI programs. And they're not as costly because they can be. But you have to be really careful about it.
Okay. The lady in the black and... I think it's black and white. It might be chocolate and white.
Blue and white.
Blue. Oh, I missed on both counts. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
My claim is I've got lights in my eyes.
Uh-huh. I would like to ask you to say a bit more about what you mean when you use the word woke. Because my understanding of it would be that it's a derogatory term used about anything that has to do with social justice or progressive ideas rather than the name of a movement that people would identify themselves as being part of. So can you please explain a bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah. I'm a self-described progressive, actually. And that's why, the subtitle of the book is The Left Way Back from Woke, because I don't think woke is left. Now, the term was actually used in a really progressive way by African Americans in the United States. It comes from the refrain of a song, Master and Teacher. It's a rap song with a refrain which says, stay woke, which means, just be careful, be vigilant, especially, in terms of police brutality, etc., which was really high up in the, up to 5-6 years ago, with George Floyd, Michael Ferguson, etc. But then it was again hijacked by, like Amanda gave the example, just like the example of Me Too, it was hijacked by middle-class privileged people and started to be used to describe all forms of identity activism, not social justice activism. Now, the term woke is used in a negative way by the right to criticize everything that is, you know, like the DEI industry, etc. The original term was progressive, and I don't think it's the term itself is salvageable. But social justice, yes. I mean, that's what I believe in. And I think, you know, that was my book was the first one, even though it's just, it hasn't even been a year. In Australia, it was published in June. It's the first book that criticizes these ideas from within a progressive tradition, because I believe that it's a betrayal of the values that we believe in or we must believe in. That's something that unites, you know, all right or left, liberals, etc., you know, who believe in freedom, values, social justice, and all of that. We may disagree on issues regarding economy or, I don't know, culture, but the point is, you know, we should be able to speak to each other, and that's the thing that woke started to stop. That's what I mean by woke. I am using it in a pejorative sense, not the original sense of the term used by the African American activists. What is woke now is are the people who actually, you know, started calling me a bigot just because I'm appearing on Adelaide on the stage with Amanda, for instance. That is something that I cannot comprehend.
We've got three more questions, Wilmot, and about 7 minutes, so just to let you know. Yes, the gentleman in the T-shirt.
Okay.
Hello. With what means can we be sure that things can never get better, that progress can never be made, no pun intended? What can the average person do?
My first suggestion is a very simple one. I tried to come up with some suggestions in my final chapter. As I said, I don't just like to be complaining and whining and whinging about things. And the first one is very simple, to listen. One of the examples that I use, I'm looking at the clock, Amanda, don't worry. There's a Berkeley professor, Ali Russell Hochschild. She was one of the few people who foresaw Donald Trump's victory. Why? Because she went to Louisiana. She left Berkeley, typical Berkeley professor that you can think of, huh? Progressive, lefty, et cetera, et cetera. She went to Louisiana to meet with Tea Party voters. Then she relocated there, spent 5 years with Tea Party voters and understood the problems. Now, she didn't agree with their solutions, voting for Trump, but she learned a lot from them. And then, you know, the title of her book was Strangers in Their Own Country. And it was published before Trump was elected. So that's the ordinary what we can do. You know, I'm here. If I were there, I would like to have like a chat, a coffee with you and listen to you, for instance. Now, you don't have to have read my book. Just want to know more and more. That's what I do in my classes. I have students from all over the world and I just want to learn from them. Then maybe, you know, we can come up with certain solutions.
Is that a bit like Hillbilly Elegy, that book?
Maybe. I don't know. Doesn't matter. Depends.
Anyway, look, we've got another gentleman and I jumped in. I shouldn't have. He's in a...
Yeah.
I think it's a brown striped shirt. I'll chance my arm.
Sort of brown. You were pretty scathing about short courses in large organisations to change culture. And I wouldn't suggest that they're the answer to all the problems. But large organisations are good targets because there are a lot of people in them, so you can get at a lot of people. And it's not practical to expect a 3-week full-time course to affect change there. So how do you affect change in such organisations?
By instilling the values that this course is supposed to teach into the culture of the company. See, one of the figures that these studies have found is that pretty much all of the first 500 companies in Fortune list, the largest companies, have these kinds of treatments. And only, even though, for instance, people of color, African Americans, like are the majority of in certain sectors, you know, in the populations, etc. There's still a minority in these companies when it comes to executive positions, etc. So that's exactly the problem. Unless you change slowly the culture, you adapt these values into the culture of the company, the short fixes on their own will not be enough. I mean, instead of just going paying to $20,000, you know, dollars to someone who would come and preach you and tell you that, first of all, you're a racist. I use the example of Alcoholics Anonymous because these trainings is like that. You know, you have to stand up and say, my name is Umut, I'm a racist. And then go on. It doesn't work like that. It's not an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting, and the moderator in those meetings don't get $20,000. It requires a leap of faith. You know, you have to do the most of the job yourself. With guidance, yes, but, you know, it's a whole mental change.
I'd like to just suggest to the gentleman, if you, in your travels in life, find someone who has an answer to that question, how to do that, how to change the culture in a big bureaucracy, patent it, don't tell anyone, come to me, and we'll sell it to the companies as to how they should do it. I mean, it is very hard. Take a university, for example, that wants to focus on discouraging sexual harassment. So you run some courses for the lecturers. They're all a bit annoyed that you think they're sexual harassers. You've actually just made it worse. It is it's a perfect question and not an easy, I don't think anyone's got the answer yet. But we do know that running a short course isn't, and paying someone $20,000 isn't it. That we do know. But I share your desire to find the answer. The lady in the rainbow dress.
Thank you. Another sensitive one. I'm interested in the mechanism behind this selective outrage that a lot of people practice. So we've had large crowds of people clapping away when someone says, oh, it's terrible what Israel does to a certain other group. Now, we live in a country that for 230 years has, you know, well known to have been a colonial country which took over other people's land. And I don't even compare Israel and Aboriginal people with Australia and, you know, Palestinian people. I'm not drawing any direct comparisons there. In fact, Jews were refugees. They probably had more legitimacy to need to be there. But how is it that people who happily live and enjoy this beautiful space and just go, we want to say we're meeting on the land of so-and-so people, and, you know, actually admit it, and that's supposed to cure everything because we've acknowledged that it was someone else's country, and yet take great joy in clapping about the bad things.
Have you got a question for Umut?
Yes. What is that mechanism? What is that psychological mechanism that people can forget what they do and love to point the finger at someone else? Ah.
The finger pointing.
Yeah, because it's exactly. It's because it's easier to scapegoat, to find people to blame, than to recognize them, to acknowledge them. See, it all, I mean, I do sound like a cheesy, whatever, life coach, but it's not that, you know, it's politics. You can be able to say that what Hamas did was atrocious, it was a war crime, but you can also should be able to say that what Israel is doing right now is not simply a right to defense. So, you know, and then this is, and this requires, because you gave the example, acknowledging the existence and the value, the dignity of the other. That's simple. And that's the way to peace. Now, it sounds simple, but actually finger pointing is the one that works faster and more efficient. And that's, I think that's about our nature, no? I mean, yeah. But it is possible.
For all the faults, you may not have heard this story, Umut. For all the faults of Henry Kissinger, let's face it, we've all got them, our faults. He used to sit down in a mediation where people wanted to explain what their differences were. I'll tell you my story. No, I'll tell you my story. It would get the differences clear. He used to say, I'm not interested in that, thanks very much. What I want to do is start on what you agree on. Do you agree you want to find a solution? Don't have to go to the argument first. Do you agree we should try and start that today? Very simple. And just keep filling up the page with what we agree on so that in the end, after quite long hours apparently, the difference appeared in a different perspective. And you can only do that if we do, Umut, what you say. When the gentleman asked, what can we do? Well, we can listen. Listen to what the other person says instead of, I think, you think. I think we're nearly out of time, but Umut, you were asked the question about, quotas, and you pointed out they can be difficult. I do have to share a story about a woman I wasn't going to like because she was in the Senate and she chose to go to the lower house, which in my view is not called that without good reason. And I was therefore going to be not very happy with her. But some old codger from the National Party was saying, because I agree, quotas aren't it. But equally, when someone says choose on merit, you feel like saying, look, just tell me what you mean by that, mate. Anyway, some guy said that to her, turned around in his waistcoat and his gold fob chain and said, well, I think everyone should get here on merit. Not to be outdone, Kathy said, really? How did you get here? And I've loved the woman ever since. Umut Kamili, thank you very... Uz Kamili, sorry. Thank you very much for joining us. I think I'll have to wheedle some recipes out of your mother by email from you. And have a happy Easter.
Yes, thank you very much, Amanda. It was a pleasure. And big hugs from Spain to sunny Adelaide.
Ditto back. Ciao.
Ciao.
Have a good Easter with your mum. There we are, we're done. Thanks very much.